This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening, I'm Ezra Zayed alongside Caroline Oh, and you're listening to the Evening Edition. Malaysia's child sexual crime bill, that's set to be tabled sometime in March, which is only a week away. And for many Malaysians, this is a long time coming, especially after the discovery of Richard Huckel's horrid crimes against children. This was back in 2016. Much has been said about ways we can protect our kids, but they all mean nothing when there are weaknesses present in the nation's criminal justice system, or police force, lawmakers, and child welfare support. A direct result of that are very rare successful prosecutions of child sexual abuse cases in the country. Our focus this evening is to discuss these flaws and understand why they're there and what's being done to fix them. Joining us on the show is Melissa Mohamed Akher, Senior Advocacy Officer at Women's Center for Change, as well as Sharmila Sekharan, Chairman of Child Rights Advocacy Group, Voice of the Children. Melissa, Sharmila, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us. And maybe let's begin by first clarifying about the number of child sexual abuse cases that are publicly shared. In a recent report, it is said that the Malaysian government doesn't publish child sexual abuse data because it is protected under Malaysia's Official Secrets Act.
So I think that's accurate, that there's very little data available or real crunched data. Which I think is a big problem because, you know, with the right kind of information, we can then go out and run proper campaigns, create greater awareness for everyone, parents, school kids, everyone, to know the prevalence of child sexual abuse. And therefore, we can actually do something about it.
Do we know why, though? Do we know why those numbers aren't publicly shared?
Although, to be fair, the avenue that we have to the numbers usually are the questions by the parliamentarians. Mm. And we do get some numbers, but where we don't get them at all is the disaggregated data. Mm. So you don't get the breakdown. When we, as in the NGOs, write to the police, then we were told that this detailed data is protected in the Official Secrets Act. Right. So when we bring it internationally, they keep saying, yes, we do share the data in Parliament.
Yep.
But the details are what we need because we need to see at every community, at every area in Malaysia, right?
How do they justify not sharing it, though? I mean, what is the reason behind it? I'm sure that's been asked.
Because we get the one-liner, it's under the Official Secrets Act. We don't have an official reason right now. Right.
When it's under the Official Secrets Act, that's all the reason that's required, I guess, in these instances.
It's sufficient for them.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things that is important for us, the reason why we need the disaggregated data, is because, you know, there are two levels of sexual activity for young people. One is where it's sama suka sama, you know, boy and girl like each other and
consensual.
Stuff happen. So in that sense, it's consensual, although we will say that someone who's 14 can't consent,
sure.
You know, so there's that issue. But apart from that, exactly, you know, it's voluntarily entered into between people of similar age groups, as opposed to an adult going after a child, for example. Yeah.
Okay. And I think one of the things to perhaps help us understand or frame this conversation today is the need for us to sort of walk through the process and see what happens. So can you tell us, just from your experience, do you see adults acknowledging or believing their children when the children come up to them, you know, telling them about sexual abuse? How does that go?
Well, again, it really depends on the adult. You've got teachers, you've got parents, you've got caregivers who are the first point of contact for the child. And within that scope, it really depends on how aware they are that this kind of activity does happen, that children are being abused, as to whether or not they believe the child. Mm. So there are instances, even when a parent, for example, knows that something is happening because the child has complained, they may try and push it under the carpet and say, you know, no, you know, let's not make a report and let's try and find a way to resolve this. There is no resolution once a child has already been violated. There is no resolution. You need to go through the whole process of getting the child counselling and, you know, first medical care and then, you know, greater kind of psychological and mental care kind of thing. But so you do have some adults. So I, for example, I'm handling a case at the moment where a school teacher was told that a girl was being abused by a parent. And the school friend had told the school teacher, so the school teacher intervened. So there you have a teacher who's obviously very, very aware, very concerned, actually being proactive. But there are many cases where we find that, you know, there is no such care and concern for the child.
Or even awareness on, say, you know, on behalf of the adult, for example. And is that a typical scenario, as in the child doesn't go to the adult by themselves? You know, they perhaps tell a friend, tells another friend, and then tells the adult. Is that
yes,
what we see?
Yes, because we have a lot of programs where it depends on the child. Does the child understand that the boy or the girl is going through violence or sexual violence?
Do if they I know give that it's wrong?
One example, yeah, like, uncle shouldn't be touching me this way, one. And then two, it's usually brought forward when there's an observation by an adult. So when the mom brings the child to the bathroom or the teacher observes changes, clear changes in behavior. So then, because we're talking about the journey and echoing what Sharmila said, usually we encourage everyone to go through the one-stop crisis center process. This means bring the child to the nearest hospital. And everything else is supposed to move from there. So examining the child, bringing the police officer there to record the statement of the child, and the social welfare officer comes there. So that's why it's one-stop crisis center. This is supposed to work all over Malaysia, all hospitals in Malaysia.
Supposed to.
So this is one of the processes or systems where Malaysia is praised in ASEAN for having this. But we need to get it moving everywhere. It's not systematic or coordinated right now.
So some hospitals do have it, are very effective, and then you've got hospitals maybe outside the kind of major city areas which are not so established.
And the reality is that it doesn't go through the proper processes in some of these hospitals. What actually happens then when a report is made?
So with a one-stop crisis center, like what Melissa was saying, the child is taken to one place. Everyone who needs to talk to the child and get evidence and information from the child comes to that one place, preferably almost all at once, so that the child does not have to relive and retell the story over and over again. Because you've got to remember, the first time the child has told a story was to the person they complained to, the adult they complained to. And now they have to go through the process of telling the police, the prosecution, the investigators, the various doctors, welfare. You know, there are different people who need to be brought in and the story told to. So with the one-stop center, the idea is that the child only tells a story once to these professionals and then gets all the necessary help and care based on that.
Right. And so the assumption then is, with this one-stop crisis center, you have all these different parties converging and talking to the child. So are these individuals, as far as you know, well-trained? Because I also imagine that, you know, it's not just a matter of, you know, the police going there is one thing that's logistical, but, you know, there is a way of approaching a child who has gone through trauma and abuse. Are they well-trained?
For the large extent, they are. We have a fantastic D11 is the unit, police unit, that covers sexual offences against women and children. And, you know, they're actually very, very well trained and very proactive, very concerned. But again, they're understaffed, under-resourced. And, you know, there's a lot of this happening. So it's very hard for them to actually get everywhere at the right time. So very often what happens is people take children to the local police station, you know, and they don't necessarily have a D11 officer or a trained officer in those local stations, police stations.
What happens then?
So that is where the whole system kind of unravels, where the child has to retell a story. Sometimes some of the police may kind of imply that the child brought it onto themselves, in a sense, you know, through bad behavior or instigation, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, it's again the re-violation of a child through that process. So that does happen sometimes. But, you know, for the most part, D11 are very much on the ball, I think.
And also to clarify for the public, the first place you bring them to, the one-stop crisis center, what does it mean at the hospital? It's actually the accident and emergency site. So manning or the administrator over there would be the hospitals. And this is where we will always usually praise the doctors, there's usually the champions there, the doctors and the nurses. Mm. And from there on, some of the nurses even bring NGOs into the picture. Like Women's Centre for Change, the nurses will ask the consent, like, do you want support or does your child need support? And we come into the picture. Otherwise, they link up with the 11 police or the social welfare department. And maybe if they can go one off and record the child's story in an actual video recording at the child interview centre, that limits the amount of times the story has to be retold. Because again, echoing what Sharmila said, in a setting where, let's say, 6 children were abused, you wouldn't have the same level of commitment between all the parents in the case. Mm. Sometimes only one mother reports. So then they are telling the stories of the children against each other, right? So the police investigators are handling a complicated issue. And if there's other dynamics as well, if it involves 6 boys abused by elder boys, if it's a religious institution. So there's other complexities, and we really hope that the police officers, again, they're understaffed, but also on the attitudinal factors. So other than having the technical know-how, also how do you talk to a child to not traumatize the child further? That's very important.
Exactly. Are there ongoing programs to help the police understand? You know, so you said they understand D11 generally deals with it, but it's not established enough to be running throughout the country. I guess, like you said, there just aren't enough people. So are there efforts out there to educate, I suppose, the rest of the force so that they can, you know, front that when the emergency comes through, they can deal with it in the correct manner?
From our part, I think, unfortunately, not. All police are trained in handling children. But when you talk about sexual offences, it needs a greater sensitivity and greater understanding. And I don't think they're sufficiently trained, because even on what the training the police get for just handling children, to my mind, is insufficient. You actually need a much longer program and a more intensive program, and they need to have it repeated. You know, just learning something once is insufficient, especially if, you know, they then go off and handle sort of like D7 stuff, you know, or you know, the hard commercial crimes and that kind of thing.
Vice.
And then,
or D7 Vice. Is Vice, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, Vice, yeah, D9, D7, yeah. All these people. You know, and then if they're transferred back into D11 or, you know, into a normal police station, they may not actually remember a lot of what they learned because it's very, very practical.
And their training centre called the Pusat Latihan Polis or PULAPOL. So, because the core duty is investigating. So, it's almost like, okay, here are the tools for investigation and you learn one size fits all.
Like a very cut and dry process.
Yeah, so it's not divided specifically to the issue, whether it's sexual violence or domestic violence or something. And sometimes there's a watering down where other issues are said to be more important. Mm. If suddenly the hot issue is trafficking, then the focus is more on trafficking rather than handling children in a sexual violence case, for example.
Yeah. Exactly.
But so, where they've been improving is they're coming also to centres such as the National Judicial and Legal Training Centre, or in the acronym is ILCAP. So sometimes top people from Bukit Aman do attend, and it's good to see the threshing out between the agencies. So sometimes you have the blaming between the police says it's the judge's fault. The judges say that it's the police's fault.
Or the prosecutor's fault.
Or the prosecutor's fault. So when they trash it out within one training, we air it out and we try and move forward on how to improve things.
Yeah.
So this is where interagency mechanisms are supposed to function.
Yeah, to help develop a more nuanced approach, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
After this, we'll be looking at the help and support available to children in cases like this and whether the protection they receive is adequate. Join us after this on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Break from monotony, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to the Evening Edition. You're with me, Ezra Zayed, as well as my co-host Caroline O, and together in the studio with us are our guests, Melissa Mohamed Akhir from the Women's Centre for Change, as well as Sharmila Sekaran from Voice of the Children. We're talking about the flaws in our criminal justice system when it comes to child sexual abuse cases.
In the process of examining this entire situation, I can imagine a scenario where the child, him or herself, is unaware of what has actually taken place because of a lack of sexual awareness or education, because ultimately the kid is still a child. How do they then actually articulate what has taken place, because the crime might have been obvious to the parent, to a guardian, to a teacher, but the child itself might only be able to articulate just what happened.
Yeah, I'm not feeling good or something like
right.
that.
Right. How does that process?
Or a certain part of my body hurts.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. How does that take place?
That's exactly what happens. A child, you know, like if you're talking about a 5-year-old versus a 15-year-old who's been violated, if you're talking about a 5-year-old who's been violated, the 5-year-old knows that something has happened and now they don't feel so good. And that's all they need to tell the parent. But moving or the guardian. But moving forward, it's the adult that we need to train and raise awareness with, because how they react. Now, a lot of children don't tell their parents things because, and they'll tell the parent when they're asked, why didn't you tell me? Mm. Because you will react badly.
Right.
So they would rather not tell the parent and go through whatever it is they're going through, rather than have the parent react hysterically or react badly. There's also, among the older children, an awareness that something could happen to the family, right, and being afraid of that. So if you have a parent who is calm, who just takes on board what is said, they go off and have breakdown somewhere else, mm, but not with and in front of the child, mm, it will actually help the children a lot more. And I think there will be a lot more awareness of children actually then coming out and basically saying that things have been happening to them.
Yeah.
But if we're talking about, like, you know, going back to a 5-year-old, that's exactly what they'll do. They'll say, you know, a certain part of me hurts. And if questions are asked, like, oh, why, and things like that, they will say, oh, so-and-so touched me or it hurt after this event. You know, I was taken to the toilet and given a bath and, you know, after that it hurt. Given about by this particular person. So then the parent needs to know, the guardian needs to know what to do. And the first thing and the best thing that they need to do, and, you know, this is really a public awareness statement, is to take them to the hospital, to One Stop Crisis Center, and let the professionals take over.
Because it's important for the professionals to take over, because you start considering the sense of shame or embarrassment that the child may or may not feel, or perhaps confusion from the entire process. And I think that's such a difficult thing to extract from a child who doesn't know anything.
Especially, I think, when the perpetrator is known to the child, because I believe a lot of these cases, these perpetrators are actually known to the child, known to the family. They've sort of integrated themselves into the family life. So it's difficult, isn't it, to open your mouth and actually say something about it. That's why you're afraid things will fall apart.
Yeah, quite right. Most cases, the perpetrator is known to the child. Mm. And sometimes what has been established is a long process of gaining the trust of the child, getting the child familiarized to the touch. So when instinctively the child feels something is wrong, the child might still be confused because of the manipulations of the perpetrator in targeting a particular child.
And it's also the language that the perpetrator uses, you know, because it's a lot of secrecy, it's our little thing, you know, it's you and me against the world, it's all that kind of stuff, which initially sounds okay, because
it's exciting to a child sometimes, isn't
absolutely
it?
Yeah. And you know, children have these imaginary friends, so this kind of like feeds into that whole kind of, you know, thinking, and then the slide happens, like Melissa was saying.
And picking up on the issue of language, we the adults have to improve in that we have to match the child's language, the child's voice. So the question just now, like, if the child uses a phrase such as, excuse me, like bird or something, so the police, the courts, whoever dealing with the child has to match how the child is able to express his or herself. Because even in research, it is said, like, especially for children below 6, sexual fantasy is not a theme of childish fantasy. They don't fantasize these parts. And it's very, like, descriptive, but in a child's language. So have we advanced to a stage where we are addressing the child, or we expect the child to make us understand?
Yeah.
So that is where we're still quite weak.
And what point does a family bring in a lawyer to, I guess, begin a legal process? Does that happen at the hospital itself where everybody is gathered, or does that happen much later on?
Well, the lawyers are useful only insofar as giving guidance and advice to the family. But really, at the first instance, if the entire mechanism and process and procedures work properly, then actually the lawyer is not really necessary at that point at all. If at all, even a lawyer would only come in, and this is something that, you know, a lot of the children's groups are advocating, that we do have child advocates who go in during the court process. So once the perpetrator is being charged, that the child does have a lawyer who stands kind of with the child and who basically guides the child through the process, in particular if the child has to give evidence. And very often what we try to do is we try to introduce the child to the entire court system well in advance of the actual hearing itself.
How
so
do
that
you do
it's
that?
Not so that it's not new to the child. So, you know, it's through pictures initially. For older children, we can even take them to the court once court is out of session. Just to even take them to the court building makes a big difference, because this may be the first time, the hearing would be the first time a lot of them would have ever gone or thought about courts.
So it's about because it's intimidating, isn't it? The building, it's a familiarization, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. So how we run this is we work together with many organizations in Malaysia. So one, we try and identify the child advocate. So this person must be child sensitive. And another point is train in the criminal justice process. Mm. So you have to understand the process to explain it in a child's language. And we have publications or methods such as using videos with cartoons. But maybe this hasn't been developed for younger children. More of the journey itself. So what happens next is the question. So why do you have to come here? Something like that. Who will sit inside the court? Mm. And these are your choices. Let's use something called, for example, the video live link. So the child sits in another room facing a computer screen and seeing the judge or the questions being posed by the prosecutor or the lawyer from there and not needing to see the perpetrators or the accused's face at that moment.
Or to be in the courtroom proper.
Mm. Correct.
With the perpetrator.
Yeah. So these options, because we do have something called the Evidence of the Child Witness Act. So with clear rights. However, we're still facing difficulties and we really need the child advocates, because for now we still have defense counsel objecting that the use of the video live link is unconstitutional to the rights of the accused. Mm. So we still have that. There's the misconstruing that these rights for the child under the law takes away from the accused rights. Mm. Actually, there's a balance. The accused can still ask questions, can still cross-examine through the lawyer. It's just that, why do you want to traumatize the child further? So this is where the child advocate is there, so that the law is applied properly and there's a balance in the interest of justice.
Yeah. And but the child is protected, because that's the most important thing, you know. Protection of children is the most important thing in this whole process.
Now, we'll have to head in for the news, but don't go anywhere, because we'll be picking up from where we left off about protection for children in these cases. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Evening Edition. I'm Ezra Zayed alongside Caroline Oh. We've been having a discussion about the flaws in our criminal justice system when it comes to child sexual abuse cases and how, as a result, it had led to fewer successful prosecutions. Discussing this with us in the studio are our guests, Melissa Momanakhir, Senior Advocacy Officer at Women's Center for Change, and Sharmila Sekharin, Chairman of Child Rights Advocacy Group, Voice of the Children.
When an investigation is underway and the perpetrator or suspect is still at large, what protection is provided to the child? Because that person could be somebody unknown, or it could be actually somebody quite familiar, unfortunately.
Somebody near home?
Unfortunately, very little protection is given to the child at the moment. You know, like Melissa was saying, actually majority of the cases are known. It's just a case of whether you're able to prove that something has happened, because very often, especially with slightly older children, so we're talking beyond the age of five, you know, we're talking about like 8-year-olds and early teens. Very often, you know, something's been happening over a period of time, and it's only right at the end that they come forward and say, oh, you know, I've been violated. Mm. And so a lot of the evidence is gone. You know, for example, you can't actually, so you know the child has been interfered with, but who interfered with the child?
And what kind of evidence is needed?
Sorry, before we go into the evidence, could we go back to the point of protection? Mm-hmm. Because the protection goes in through each step of the journey.
Yeah.
So let's say at the first stage, reporting stage, and then investigation, and then bringing it to court. Mm. So there are marks in escalation. depending on how nervous the perpetrator would get. Oh no, the case is progressing through the investigation. Oh no, I'm being charged in court. Mm. So the intimidation or the re-traumatization of the child might escalate this way. Mm. And this is where the agencies must be aware. And there's something called the Child Act. Yep. So the Child Act is supposed to issue orders to protect children who are categorized as children in need of protection. So let's say sexual violence, that's one category, mm-hmm. right? There's been a report, blah, blah, blah. So what does it mean in real life? So one, the perpetrator is not supposed to approach or speak to the child when the case is being investigated. Others, third parties, are not supposed to approach during the case. But we find many a time, even some law firms are involved in offering money. So the big issue that we face on the protection modes is so many cases are withdrawn because of intimidation. So many cases are also... parties maybe promise money as a form of settlement.
But how do you ideally enforce something like that? So protecting the child every step of the way, what is the right way?
You can get the orders through the court. So yeah. The Child Act just now, yeah. It's an order that could be issued by the court for children mm-hmm. to say this person is prohibited from approaching.
Sort whether of a restraining order sort of thing?
A bit like an injunction, mm-hmm. but stronger because it's specific under the Child Act. Mm. And
the prosecutor should be asking for these. But that is where a child advocate would be very, very useful as well to ensure, because that's the role of the child advocate, to ensure the protection of the child rather than the prosecutor's focus, which is to kind of win the case.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when they get the file, meaning when they first read out the charge against the perpetrator, right. They're supposed to argue about bail. So when you argue about bail, you can ask for this protective order as well, and you can ask for bail conditions. Right. Shall not approach whether through third parties or any means of communication, something like that. But this must be done in every case. To be fair, we have seen it done when the parties are family members. Mm. So if it's an incest case, automatically, usually the prosecutor says they live in the same house. So I object against bail. Or if you say bail is a right because there's no conviction yet, you have to put protective conditions. How to avoid the contact. Or because this is a star witness, right? This is a star prosecution witness, the child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what kind of evidence is needed?
Well, at the first level, the fact that the child has been interfered with, but that's more or less quite easily obtained. The harder evidence is actually pointing to who the perpetrator is. So you actually need samples of, for example, semen and things like that, where the child can say that, you know, something has just happened and this is who it is, and we have the evidence for that. Mm.
The bigger area of where we haven't addressed yet, but most of the cases are, if a child is molested, if the injury can't be seen visibly, like, again, molestation or oral sex.
Mm. Or so even grooming,
because
that's already the start of a violation.
Yeah, or like showing pornography or whatever to a child. So in that sense, understanding of how to prove it is very, very limited. So many cases, because there's even remarks to say we can't see anything, we can't see any injuries.
So even if it's a mental trauma, it's not considered.
Yeah, when the penal code says injury includes injury to the mind, to the reputation. So that's already in the law, but how to apply it in real life, there's a big gap. And the use of child psychiatrists or pediatricians or whatever, that shouldn't be, as in what the child says in court should be evidence firsthand. You don't have to see the injury to believe that a child has been injured.
And why is there reluctance to see that as an injury?
I just don't think we're advanced enough, really. And I think there's lack of awareness and understanding of how a child being violated is a greater injury rather than just the immediate violation in itself.
A lack of understanding by the courts?
By the courts, by the prosecution,
the investigators,
everyone, right down the line.
And so how long do these types of cases take? Because I guess you were mentioning very, very briefly earlier about the number of cases that do get settled out of court because of various instances of intimidation by certain parties, that these cases just get settled and not a lot of cases actually get solved.
Well, the worrying thing is not just the settled cases, it's how many cases that actually do go to court do we actually secure a conviction for? Mm. And even that is very limited from what we can see, from the data we have seen.
What numbers are we talking about?
So WCC's numbers, we've done a research in the lower courts in Penang. So it's for all sexual offences, which, of course, the majority of it is for people below 18, children. Right?
And this is just in the state of Penang?
This is just for Penang. So this was published in 2009, and it says less than 3%. And the highest number of cases are discharged, not amounting to an acquittal.
Less than 3% conviction rate.
Conviction rate for cases that are brought to court. But overall, for 100% of the 439 files that were examined, the most amount of the cases don't go through the process. It's discharge, not amounting to an acquittal.
And this comes back to what Melissa was saying, that, for example, at the moment, we still need a complainant to come to court. So we still need the so-called, in inverted commas, victim, or the term we use is survivor, to be present in court, to give evidence. And very often what happens is, you know, a lot of them are unable to or unwilling to for various reasons, which means the perpetrator gets off. But we should be able to rely on the evidence and the reports from doctors, gynecologists, all the other people who've interviewed the child. We should be able to secure convictions through that.
But even in securing convictions, these cases do take a considerable amount of time, just because the way the process is at the courts, it can take up to more than a year, perhaps, or perhaps even longer. And it requires a certain amount of stamina on the part of the survivor to go through this. When the conviction is actually secured, how does the survivor feel, or how do they, I guess, move on from that particular period?
The range of cases that we have that have secured convictions range around 3 years.
3 years?
3 years to get to appeal.
Wow.
So because, you know, during trial, and then there's two more chances for appeal, right? So that's 3 years. And that's considered actually fast.
Fast.
Very fast.
Yeah, so for the cases that were acquitted, it has gone up to 4 years. And this is where research also supports that when it goes 4 years and beyond, most of the time it's acquittal. Because most of the time, and the case that we had involved a little boy who has grown up after 4 years, things have changed. He's now ashamed to tell the story and he won't go into the details. But his first video recording when he was younger was very clear. And that suddenly is said to be a contradiction.
Yeah. Mm.
But it doesn't make sense. Life goes on for the child.
And the other thing we have to remember is that, in particular for children, but I think everyone has this mechanism, but it's greater for children, we have a very good way of kind of closing our mind to bad things that have happened.
Yeah.
And it's just a process of healing and getting
surviving.
Past things, surviving.
It's the way memories are shaped as well from these types of instances.
Exactly. So to expect someone 2 years down the line to come and give as clear evidence and specific evidence as they did when something was first happening to them, most of us don't even remember what we had for breakfast.
Oh, yeah. For sure. So when you say 3 years is considered fast, I mean, are we coming in from, well, I don't know, was it like 10 years in the past? Was it, you know, where are we coming from?
That's the current realities on the ground. But of course, if we're supposed to apply the principle of ethics and the court directions or the Legal Profession Act, where lawyers should not use postponements as a specific strategy to win the case. Because actually, sadly, sexual crimes are very easily winnable for the defense because of all the complications we put it in. But delay is one of the biggest factors, especially damaging to the child. So we're coming from a system that is antiquated and very adversarial. So we don't have a system where, for example, one video recording, one questioning, and it goes on and no postponements. Yeah, we don't have that in place yet. We're trying to lobby where all the interests of the parties are taken into account, but there must be a way in that people are not traumatized further and give up on the process.
Now, we're going to take a really short break right now and continue this conversation when we come back. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
And you're back on the evening edition where our guests, Melissa Momad-Akhir from the Women's Center for Change, as well as Sharmila Sekharin from Voice of the Children, the John Caroline and myself, on this discussion about the flaws in our national criminal justice system, where child sex abuse cases are concerned. And so we've spoken a lot about some of these flaws in these respective processes. In terms of looking at reform, what is most urgent at this juncture?
I think it's all urgent, really. Well, what we're looking at is an act or law reform to strengthen the current system to ensure that, one, children are investigated only once and have to tell the story only once. Like Melissa and I have been saying, a lot of this is actually already in place. It's just the implementation which is weak and ensuring that these things happen. And I think that's actually what needs to be strengthened is our will. It's political will, it's social will to ensure that the children are protected through the entire process. Again, having a strong child advocate will help greatly because a lot of the postponements that Melissa was talking about would be objected to very strenuously. And you will have people who are articulate and who have been trained in actually explaining to court why this is damaging to the entire case and in particular to the child moving forward. What we also need are the judges and the magistrates to be strengthened for them to know and understand then how the entire process works, how child development happens, and for them to appreciate that any delay and how they can play an active role, to be a little bit more inquisitorial, because like Melissa was saying, ours is very much an adversarial system. All of us who've gone through law school have learnt it as an adversarial process. So now you're actually asking the courts, the judges, to kind of like switch their mindset a little bit.
More to fact-finding.
Yeah, to start asking questions and being a little bit more proactive in the case rather than taking a seat and just watching a boxing match happen.
But is there acknowledgement that that's needed at this point?
Yeah, in the various lobbying done with the ministries, we have put in various recommendations and the finding and comparison of other countries that have done this.
Mm-hmm.
So whether the positive points or what needs to be sorted out. But just one wish list, probably we need a very clear SOP on handling of cases, which involves all of the parties. So there's a similar one already done for domestic violence, already approved by the various agencies, including the police and the AG chambers. And it acknowledges the role of NGOs that handle these cases. So specifically, for example, SOP on child sexual crimes. So there's a simple flowchart and all that. So we have found positively some cases where on the ground, even police sergeants instinctively know what to do. Not even you're not even trained in the UK with the Crown Prosecution Service, but you're able to follow through. So you just need clarity, but each party's role must be clarified. So going where that comes from, that should be the subject matter of the trainings and all that. But this SOP doesn't exist as yet.
And we need the intergovernment agencies to come in together for that.
Mm.
When Parliament goes back into session in March, the Child Sexual Crimes Bill will be tabled. How encouraging is that to some of the issues that we've discussed today?
For our part, we would actually like to see the wording. We know that there are some very key amendments being proposed or additions to the Act being proposed, for example, something on grooming. But really, the Act is as strong as the language and the implementation of it. So you can have a good Act that has excellent headings, but how those headings actually play out in the words, in the procedure, in the implementation on the ground, that's where it counts. So what we would like to see for our part is really the wording of the Act to ensure that it flows smoothly and it makes sense.
Yeah, echoing that, all we hear now are concepts. So the concepts sound good, but until we see the language, we're not sure if we can even comment. Because although there's an attempt to address new ways of how someone can be a sexual predator towards children. But let's see how the language is and how it applies.
Because it's something very subtle, like, for example, knowing and understanding how a child is reacting to a particular scenario, that you really have to know and understand that and factor it in into the wording of the legislation. You know, if you just look at the legislation like some kind of commercial legislation, you know, drafting the Contracts Act, say, for example, it's not going to work.
It has to have a lens that lends itself towards giving the perspective of a child as well, not just adults figuring out what types of laws need to be introduced.
So just one example, like a concept that has been thrown out is the specialized court for children, specifically for sexual crimes. So what does this mean? How is it run? Which type of children are acknowledged or brought forward? So does it mean that this case is supposed to be done within how long? So these details we do not know. But the concept sounds good.
I am wondering, though, you know, to the larger public, so you have their ear today, you know, how would you encourage them to, I suppose, be more aware of what is going on and what can they do? Because you need society's will, like you said, you need political will. But what can society actually tangibly do?
One, be aware that this is happening. Don't be an ostrich with your head in the sand. The rates of sexual offences against children, and it's not it's not even rape and incest we're talking about. It's even things like grooming, you know, showing porn, that kind of stuff. Getting
Especially
to
with,
children
with the introduction of technology now, with phones and the type of content that is available on these devices.
Absolutely, it's so much more accessible to children and for groomers to access the children. So parents need to be more aware. They need to actually believe and know and understand that this is happening. No longer do the boundaries of our house, the fence, protect our families inside the house. So they actually need to be proactive in finding out about what is going on with their children. They need to be alert and aware when they see changes in the child's behavior. They need to be more engaged. Very often we go out, in particular in urban areas, you go out and you see families sitting down for dinner at a coffee shop, but everyone's doing their own thing on their iPad or phones, or, you know, no one's talking to each other. And really, that's a great time to find out what's going on in a child's life. Now, I have a nephew who doesn't come home and say, oh, you know, all this happened to me in school. But when you're talking to him and doing stuff and, you know, you just ask this question and he's, oh, I don't know. But down the line, he comes up on his own and he says something. So, you know, we have to be aware that there are different kinds of children. There are those that come back and tell you everything that everybody did. And then you've got kids who, you know, are a little bit more reticent about sharing their life. But they all do. They all will. And parents have to lend their ear to this and be aware of it, that they need to know what's going on in the children's life and they need to get involved in that life.
And one message for adults is, can you please believe the child and don't be scared? Because we tend to tell children, you know, if you feel something is wrong, tell a trusted adult. The problem is sometimes we have the adults failing the children. So one example is a child tells a parent or another student and they tell the principal, who decides to say that, no, that's impossible. Or a mother slaps the child for telling the story of the abuse and, like, that's impossible, that shouldn't have happened. So when the parents or the adults are the ones who are scared, then the children totally lose the trust. Like, no one's going to help me. So we really need the adults to step up and don't be scared to be sued, because the Child Act actually protects you. If you have reasonable suspicion in a case, it seems probable, you are supposed to bring the story forward. No one can sue you for that. It actually says in the Child Act. You can't be defamed for that. So don't be scared.
There are certain people, professionals in particular, who work with children, like doctors and caregivers, who are obliged under the Child Act, who are obliged to report abuses that they find. But like Melissa said, any random person, like any of us sitting here, you know, nothing's going to happen if you actually report it. The other thing that we also have to be careful about is, you know, like Melissa mentioned principals, and very often we find that there's a lot of abuse happening in schools, teachers versus children, and also like older kids versus younger kids. A lot of that is happening. And to protect the name of the school, the entire system, including the school board, closes down. They close ranks. And that really is detrimental to the child and the entire system, because, you know, once it comes out, then, you know, it's far worse. So we would encourage even principals and school boards, PTAs, to, like Melissa said, believe the children, get involved. It doesn't have to be highlighted. If you resolve it within yourselves, it doesn't have to be highlighted. But the problem is a lot of them don't. And there are other issues that come into play.
And just short point is that you don't even have to lodge a police report. You can contact the Social Welfare Department's Child Protector as well if you don't want to lodge a report. But sometimes, if there's ding-donging, they may still ask you to lodge a report. It's just that in principle, in theory, there's supposed to be child protectors in every district in Malaysia.
And so for the parents, come from a child-first perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Melissa, Sharmila, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
That was our conversation this evening about how the flaws and gaps in our criminal justice system results in low successful child sexual abuse prosecutions. My thanks once again to our guest this evening, Melissa Mohamed Akhir, Senior Advocacy Officer at Women's Center for Change, as well as Sharmila Sekaran, Chairman of Child Rights Advocacy Group, Voice of the Children. If you know someone who you think could benefit from this discussion, get them to download the podcast. And of course, you can do that by installing our BFM app, which is available on the Apple App Store as well as Google Play. This has been the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.